Hello, good people. This is Sister Julia Walsh, and you're listening to Messy Jesus Business. Welcome to The Mess.
Hi, Messy Jesus Business listeners. I'm Father Adam Bacco, an Episcopal priest, also the director of the Center for Spiritual Imagination in New York, with locations in Long Island and Brooklyn, New York, and a previous guest on this very podcast in early 2021. This episode of Messy Jesus Business is a special one because your regular host, my good friend, Sister Julia Walsh, has written an amazing book. It's called For the Love of the Broken Body, and it will be published by Monkfish on March 26th, 2024. To celebrate this book, this beautiful creation, we decided, or actually the Messy Jesus Business team decided, that it would be interesting to flip the tables a bit and have me, a past guest, ask Sister Julia some questions for a change. And just so you know, the script that I received actually said to have a trusted, beloved voice and past guest ask Julia some questions for a change. So I'm so excited to be here with you today and to interview my good friend, Sister Julia. Hi, Julia.
Hi, Adam.
So excuse me,
Reverend. Good to be with you, Reverend.
Yeah, I got it, you know, represent. Let's get to it. So I'm so excited about this book. I've been hearing about this book for the past few years as you've been working on it. And I'm so excited that finally people will be able to read about your really beautiful journey and life story. And so I have a few questions for you about that. But before we start and dive into what the book is really about, I was wondering if you could maybe get us started by simply offering a few paragraphs from your book, something that could give us a sense of what the energy of this book is about and what is it like.
Okay, sure. So this is the beginning of chapter 39. The broken body I have grown to love is bigger than my own. My bones crushed and shattered, the teeth extracted and replaced with permanent implants, the hand forever bearing the scar next to my knuckle, the artificial tissue in my now tiny nose clicking under the pressure of a finger, my smile now slightly crooked, the scar under my chin where my face was split open for surgery. I now love all these broken parts of me. Or at least I've grown to accept them, embrace them, allow myself to carry around these wounds as reminders of what I've survived, been through, of the miracle of God's love that has reformed, reshaped, and reclaimed me. This broken body I love is also Jesus. It is the connection I felt while on my retreat before entering the novitiate, tucked away on those bluffs near the Villa St. Joseph. It is the Jesus who visited me in the ICU and taught me how to love, how to be loving presence unto others, who said, "This is who I am," so biblically. It is the holy bread, become Jesus, reverently secured in the monstrance and placed on the high altar in our adoration chapel at St. Rose Convent. Love, quiet and present. It is the bread at the center of my dreams, the overflowing and expanding potluck, inclusive and open to all who have need. It is the courage that I have gained to say yes to God with my life through the approaching profession of vows. The broken body I have grown to love is also every human who held me in my misery, who tended to my wounds, who held my hand during surgery or sickness. It is the people of God, close friends and distant strangers, my Franciscan sisters and my family, those near, those thousands of miles away. The broken body that I love and am eager to dedicate myself to includes every person living. It is those who profess they are children of God, and it is those who never consider it, and those who have turned away from God. It is those who flaunt their wealth and oppress the poor, and those who are living on the streets, under bridges, in the corners of cities. Those who are hungry, in jail, or barely getting by. It is the farmer who is going bankrupt. It is the woman who is fleeing her abusive husband. It is the teen afraid to tell their parents they are gay, that they are going to venture out on their own. It is the children in crumbling poor schools and those living in villages without a proper well. The broken body of Christ that I love is the people of God on the margins of society who know they are broken and feel the pain of being broken as they struggle through every ordinary act. It is for them that I will imitate Christ. I will offer my body as a sacrifice too. I will give up allowing anyone to love my broken body in the ways that are natural, normal. I will not get married. I will not have sex. I will renounce the pleasure and pain and mystery of knowing what it is to share my broken body with another human, to bond in the most intimate of ways, to celebrate the communion of the wedding bed. This renouncement will unleash the power of my love, allow my expansive love to be given to the greater good. I am not worthy of this, but I believe that through my surrendering to God's grace, good can come.
Wow. Thank you so much for sharing that. What a beautiful passage. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
So I have a lot of questions about just the process of writing and what was the journey that you took. But maybe since you shared this beautiful passage and that has so much in it, I would just love to start instead with a little bit of your journey. So broken body, can you tell us about that, and especially the accident that you sort of opened the book with? What happened?
Yeah. I was a month into my novitiate with my religious community, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. And around that time, I found out that my parents decided to sell the farm that I grew up on in Iowa. Now, as a novice, I was expected to take one day of silent prayer a week, which we called a hermitage day. The farm that I grew up on was only a 90-minute drive away from the mother house, from the community of sisters that I joined in Wisconsin. So I got permission from my formation director to go back to the farm for a day of quiet prayer. The plan was that I was going to camp in the woods and just spend a night praying and saying goodbye to the land and reflecting on the fact that this is where I'm from, but it's not my home anymore. Within a short time of me getting settled there, though, I tried to climb down a cliff to go swimming in the creek that I used to play in with my siblings. Unfortunately, the rock crumbled when I was climbing down, and I fell face first about 20 feet into this creek, which had a limestone creek bottom. I ended up breaking my hand and really everything in my face, from my eyebrows to my chin. Some of my teeth broke and fell right out of my face immediately. I could tell my jaw was split open. And then I was all alone in the woods, and I had to figure out what to do. And I eventually made it back to the farmhouse and was able to call 911, and my family and the paramedics and everyone arrived around the same time. Then I was a novice recovering from this accident while I was also discerning whether I was called to religious life and if I really wanted to make my first profession of vows of poverty, celibacy, and obedience. So I think having to be doing these layers of work of healing and integration of my accident while I was also deepening my communion with Christ and learning what it meant to really be a sister, learning what the vows meant, learning what Franciscan charism was, it just made for a pretty complex story. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of wild things that happened. And, you know, I was 25 years old when this is all going on. Mm-hmm. So I entered the convent pretty early. I hadn't really worked through all my questions related to celibacy and sexuality. And so I was also working through those questions while I was healing and recovering. So the story is a story of, yes, my personal brokenness and physical trauma and the healing and the recovery of that. But I'm hoping that even more so, it's a story about the Eucharistic Christ, mm-hmm. and how all of us are called to live a Eucharistic story with our life. We all are blessed. We are all chosen and beloved by God. We all are broken in different ways. I hope my book normalizes brokenness. Mm-hmm. And we all are called to share of our lives, share who we are, share from our brokenness. We don't ever have to be good enough to give our lives and give ourselves over to God or to others or to some sort of goodness in the world. And I'm hoping that my meditations and experience and story helps others to come to know that mm-hmm. in their own stories.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. And I mean, you talk about it so beautifully. And I think the passage that you shared with us just minutes ago really kind of captures the essence of that. When you were sort of discerning to become a religious sister, and I know that we have this argument about whether you're a nun or not. You used to tell me that you're not, but then obviously you wrote a book about being a nun, so I
think I won
in the end.
You did not! Read the glossary. There is a difference between nun and sister.
Okay, okay.
So what's the question, Adam?
So the question is, you felt called to this specific religious order that has a very specific charism. Obviously, it's a Franciscan order mm-hmm. inspired by St. Francis and St. Clare, but also it has the Eucharist at the very center of its life. And of course, these days we talk a lot about Sister Tia Bowman, whom you mention in the book, who was also a religious sister in your congregation, in your order. And so I'm wondering what attracted you specifically to that community.
So I had a friend in college named Andy, who was familiar with my community, the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. Towards the end of college, when I basically had like my coming out and told all my friends, hey, I think I'm supposed to do this thing with my life and be a sister. I probably said none. Yes, Adam. But anyway.
Mm-hmm. Thank you again.
So I was at Loras College in Dubuque, Iowa, where there was a bit of a vocation culture. People had different suggestions for communities, but Andy knew me really well. And he described the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration, who I'm now going to say FSPA for short. And he said, you know, I think they're the community for you because they are academics and they're artsy and they're activists and they're involved in advocating for social change, for justice. Yet they're really prayerful and devout and they're committed to their devotion of perpetual adoration. By that time, I had already visited some other convents, but when I visited that community, I just knew. I was like, oh, yeah, this is where I'm supposed to be. And I think it's because there's like an earthiness, an organicness about who we are as sisters that's just really real and accessible and relatable. And I never felt intimidated, even though my sisters are so smart. But I felt like, oh, I could share my life here, you know? And there was such a resonance in what Franciscan charism is. And I've always been a lover of the Eucharist. So all these things came together. And I had a sense that, wow, if I join this community of sisters, I'm totally going to get to be me. Uh-huh. And I'm going to be like able to grow and develop and become an even brighter light because the sisters mm-hmm. would help that to happen. And that's totally been my experience 18 years later. Absolutely.
That's wonderful. I love that you knew that you would totally be able to be yourself. How amazing that is. And, you know, so many people, when they think about holiness or spiritual life or religious life, somehow the initial assumption is that they will have to become somebody else. But the experience of God can only happen in our lives, not yes. somewhere else. It's amazing that you had that sense. In the book, you says that there are two films or two movies about nuns that really kind of,
right.
I don't know what to call it, just gave you an image what a religious sister could yeah. be. And one of them is The Sound of Music that I don't know. And one of them is Sister
Act. You don't?
Act. No, I know Sister Act, but I don't know.
What the heck, Adam? Yeah. Come over and watch The Sound of Music with me,
well,
please.
Well, one of these days when I make my way to Chicago, we have to do that. So, you know, I think my question is still about vocation and the role of prayer and discernment. Because I think a lot of people may be listening to this, and I would hope a lot of people would read your book who are in discernment, who maybe also had seen a movie or had an inspiring priest or a religious brother or a religious sister, and somehow are asking this very basic but very difficult questions about vocation. Mm-hmm. I think my question is related to, like, yes, movies. You also talk a lot about prayer opening you to God and all that. What's your advice for people who are asking questions about religious life? And how can your book support their journey?
Yeah, isn't it kind of ironic? I think so, that I'm actually the vocation minister
you
for my
are.
Community
and
now.
And you wrote a book, which is really a book about your vocation. And I love that paragraph when you just, what am I hearing? Be a nun.
Right. Yeah. Even though I had that experience when I was, 17, mm-hmm. where I felt like the voice of God was speaking to me and telling me to be a nun in my prayer, I wasn't sure about it probably until final vows, right? I say that to introduce an answer to your question, which is like, discernment of one's vocation is not like a personality test. It's not like you just fill in bubbles and then you get some results spit out to you that tell you who you are. It's not a career aptitude test. It's really a journey of exploration and discovery. Mm-hmm. And as you're getting to know yourself better, you're also hopefully getting to know God better. And you're getting to see how you and God are called to some sort of partnership. Mm-hmm. And each of us, no matter what our vocation, we're all called to be partners with God, to co-create our lives with God. When I was a lot younger and had a less mature understanding of discernment, what I was looking for was a treasure map that then I would follow that would then lead me to exactly where I was supposed to go and give me all the answers about how I was supposed to give my life to God. I was agonizing about that. And I was like, how am I supposed to find the answers to all these questions? And it put so much pressure on myself. Mm-hmm. And I remember I met with a pastor, she was a Lutheran pastor actually, about these questions when I was probably just a freshman in college, shortly after I had that initial experience in prayer where I felt like God was telling me to be a nun. And I described this image to her in this agony, and she said, I'd like you to imagine that what God is instead putting before you is a path, mm-hmm. and you get to move around that path, and you don't have to stay in one lane.
Yeah.
And that path is a path of love.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me so much more freedom and joy to recognize there is a call. The call is great, but the call is common. And what I got to do is choose to respond to God's love in a way that I knew would help me to become the happiest, healthiest, holiest person I could be.
And that's such a good advice.
Oh, my word, right?
That's such a good advice. Because, you know, I mean, in the book, you talk quite a bit about having doubts. I mean, you were pretty young, the question of celibacy, and also some experiences of falling in love or developing, you know, attraction towards people. Like seeing all of that within the framework of this advice that you got just makes so much more sense. It's still complicated, but, you know, in a way that all life is always complicated. So now, how have you dealt with doubts? How have you felt with, you know, coming to terms that saying yes to this particular path means saying no to so many things, especially, you know, relationships?
Marriage. I would have been an awesome wife and a phenomenal mom, right? I mean, obviously. So how am I living my commitment, right? Is I think what you're really asking, Adam. And what is commitment and why does it matter? I reflect a lot on this because it seems to me that part of the Christian vocation, being a disciple of Jesus Christ, requires that all of us take our commitments seriously. And some of the commitments of being part of the church, maybe we didn't choose. My parents baptized me when I was 6 days old. I didn't have a choice in the matter, but I'm sure glad they baptized me, mm-hmm. right? And I'm sure glad I was raised as a Christian. This is my identity. But there was obviously a point in my journey, in my development, where I said, yes, I am a Christian. This is who I am. This is the authentic way to express my identity in the world. So how then can I live out that commitment in a way that contributes to my own wellness and flourishing, as well as the goodness and flourishing of others? I suppose when I was preparing for final vows, so this would be 6 years after the conclusion of the book, I remember I wrote in my letter to my congregational leadership team, the FSPA leadership, that I was aware of my ability to fall in love easily. I admitted this outright mm-hmm. to my sisters and said that it was something that I expected to be wrestling with for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. But it was something that I wanted to be wrestling with within the container of community life and within the container of the vows, because I think that the vows of poverty, celibacy, and obedience allow me to have a greater freedom to live my love for God than other lifestyles would. Mm-hmm. So yeah, do doubts and desires go away? No, absolutely not. They're part of what I carry with me. What I'm challenged to do is to live in a way where I'm constantly returning to Christ and returning to my commitments and saying yes again and again to living out those commitments with more boldness and more joy and more freedom. Mm-hmm. It's a lot of work. Oh man, yeah. Just the other day I went to church with one of my friends, beautiful person, and I was sitting there and during Mass and I was like feeling so overwhelmed with love and I was thinking, "Oh my gosh, am I falling in love with another friend?" and then I was like, oh, maybe I just love Mass, right? Like, I mm-hmm. love the people of God. And that makes more sense to me. Mm-hmm. I was at the liturgy where the Eucharistic love was, and I was encountering that love and feeling that love for everyone in that moment. Mm-hmm. That feels like the truest expression of who I am.
Mm-hmm. For people who are intrigued by the religious life, especially as it is expressed within the Roman Catholic Church, one question that arises for some young people is that the religious orders are getting older. And you allude to that in your book as well. This question of not being around people your own age, oftentimes. Oh, yeah. How does one journey through those questions about celibacy, through those questions that a 20-something-year-old or 30-something-year-old would have mm-hmm. when you're sort of surrounded by sisters who are in a different stage of life, very wise sisters, but not necessarily maybe struggling with similar things. Yeah. How do you wrestle with that? And what's your advice for people who are sort of maybe are afraid to consider religious life because of that?
I think that that's an important reality, especially here in the United States, for discerners to be taken into consideration in their discernment. I think that I was encouraged to choose to apply to enter the FSPA community because there were other women mm-hmm. who were closer to my age when I was applying and looking and entering. And so that was really helpful. I actually have felt like I've had peers in my community all along. Mm-hmm. But it's true that religious life, the shape and the size and the look and the feel of it here in the U.S., especially in women's communities, is really changing. This is a time of great shifts and flux. So I would say that the gift and the grace of this time in church history and religious life is that many more things happen intercongregationally. So mm-hmm. as the readers will discover when they read the book, my formation was along with newer religious and other communities. When I was a novice, the intercongregational novitiate that I was a part of was a co-ed experience. Mm-hmm. And that was really life-giving for me. Mm-hmm. That helped me to know that what I was giving my life over to was something that was bigger than me, bigger than my own community. I was joining a really global church movement. Mm-hmm. It's complex and layered, but like if a person is really asking themselves the questions of like what sort of relationships help me to know happiness and joy and wellness, and is also able to do the work of balancing their life with other types of relationships, then I think it's fine.
Mm-hmm. Before we dive into questions about the process of writing the book and also what you hope, you know, people can take away from the book, in your book, you reproduce some conversations with other young persons. One that I can think of is a person named Mike. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that? Just friendships in religious life, friendships with people who stay, friendships with people who leave, friendships with people from other congregations, friendships that at times maybe are a bit confusing and at times life-giving.
So first of all, I should tell you that Mike is not really his name, right?
Yes, I assumed that was the case.
Yeah, yeah. And he's fully aware of the book. He approved the manuscript in its earliest draft and has been very, very supportive of the project. So I'm really grateful for him.
Should we be asking about updates on Mike as to where he is? No, we won't go there now.
Yeah, he can keep his privacy if he wants. Mm-hmm. Also, Mike is a conflation of a couple people. Mm-hmm. And when I was looking through my journals from the time period, from the novitiate, I think I counted up like four people that I had feelings for. And I was trying
Goodness,
to go
Julia,
through.
Julia, your heart is just too big or something.
So there was one version of the earliest draft. I think I had two or three guys that I was trying to sort through my feelings for. And my earliest readers were like, Julia, this was too confusing for us. So I mushed them all mm-hmm. together into Mike.
Yeah, so I think the question stands like friendships with people who stay, who
yeah.
leave.
Yeah.
Friendships yeah. that are life-giving, but also maybe confusing. And sometimes, mm-hmm. even though those could be friendships of mutual support on a vocational yeah. journey, nonetheless, sometimes they kind of are in conflict with our vocations, right?
Yeah, sometimes, right. I'm thinking, as you asked the question about some of the hard relationships, experiences that I've had that have been experiences of real suffering in the past few years. Mm-hmm. One of my dear friends, who I felt like was part of religious life with me from the beginning, chose to leave and get married. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, in a way, I felt so heartbroken. And I didn't even understand like why I was just crying, because it's not like I was married to this person. Mm-hmm. But I remember I took it to my spiritual director, who is a priest and in religious life himself. And he commented that there's more support for people who are divorced in church and society than there is for people who choose to stay committed to religious life and other people choose to leave. Mm-hmm. That type of heartbreak is not understood by people. Mm-hmm. And that type of loss. And I really had to go through a major grieving process, and I had to let my friend go and allow them to live into their choice and become married. And they are happily married. But navigating the complex layers of friendship, whether it's with people that are close or far, or that there is any sort of like sexual attraction to or total platonic friendship, no matter what, my vow of poverty invites me to not cling to anyone. My vow of celibacy means that I am challenged every day to let go of everyone and allow them to live the lives that they live and recognize and accept that people will come and go through my lives. Whoever is in my life when they are, my job is to love them the best that I can. Mm-hmm. It's really hard because there's definitely people that I want to be super close to for like as long as my life is going on. Mm-hmm. But that's not always possible.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the technicalities of writing a book, how did you know that you wanted to write this book?
Oh, man. I can see now that I've always had a heart for story. Mm-hmm. And good storytelling and good stories have always mattered to me. Also, good symbols and messages, right? Like, that all matters a lot to me. Mm-hmm. While I was going through the experience of my novitiate, of the accident, and all the things that happened in the hospital, and the encounters with Christ that I had along the way, just all these little details of things, even in the midst of all that, I was like, bewildered and amazed with like, this is quite the story. Someone should write this down. Mm-hmm. And then as I healed and I made my vows and I lived into the life of FSPA and my identity as a sister, I found that I couldn't stop thinking about this story and how powerful it is. And in alignment with my vow of poverty, I felt like I couldn't keep this story to myself. Mm-hmm. I felt like I had to share it because I recognized there was a power in the story for others. And this was part of the gift I was meant to give through my vocation. Mm-hmm. It required that I did a lot of serious work, soul work, a lot of personal work, professional work. I had to learn how to write, honestly. I studied craft. I went to writer's workshops. I developed relationships with folks that knew what they were doing and asked them to coach me along, and they sure did. And, you know, all that like supported this sense of call that I had that I was meant to share this story. So I'm very excited that the book came into the world now and anyone can read it. Goodness gracious, please know though that I do feel vulnerable. Yeah. Like there are parts in this book that I don't think I could like tell. You know, you're one of my closest friends. And I don't even think I've ever told you any of these things.
No, I mean, I learned so much, you know, reading this. But see, that's the thing, you know, like once you start.
It's easier to put it on the page.
Yeah, of course. And then it's right? time for the book to come out. And, you know, I know the things that I've written. It's like everything is fine. And then the day before the date when it's supposed to come out, I just have a major freak out thinking like, oh, my God. People will be reading this.
I know. Yes, exactly. I've been feeling like I've been freaking out for as long as this whole thing's been going on. Yeah.
But so a little bit more just about the process. You said that you had to become friends with people who coached you and asked for help all along the way. And that's what happens with books, right? But I'm curious if you could tell us what were the steps from that initial intuition that this particular story that you are part of does not just belong to you, that you have to gift it to the world. What were the steps from that intuition to actually now being able to hold this book in your hand? You know, with publishing and editing and writing and rewriting, what was that like? And
honestly, it was terrible. I kept thinking of a few different things. One is, as you know, Adam, I'm not athletic, but I do like a good hike, right? So a really good long hike where you're like traversing up and down hills and you're getting tired and you're getting sweaty and dirty and like you're even in dark, scary corners and right? Mm-hmm. And you get a little lost and a little confused, but then you find your way back to the path. And then somehow you arrive to this phenomenal vantage and you're like, wow, how did I get here? Yeah. It's strenuous and it's adventurous. It's laborious. It's super intense, right? Mm-hmm. And just like a really good hike, it's transformative. Reflecting on my story again and again and again meant that the story was integrated into me more deeply, mm-hmm. right? And now I don't have to wonder, what did my journal say when I was a novice? Like, I know it. I reread all of them. Mm-hmm. I got the medical records from the hospital mm-hmm. and studied what they said after my accident. I interviewed family and friends who were part of the story about what their memories were, mm-hmm. right? I went through all my emails from that time period mm-hmm. and the Gmail instant message chats, mm-hmm. right? All that became data for me to put this story together. And it was such a weird thing to do mm-hmm. to like just study 2 years of my life. But it meant the first draft was like at least 50,000 words longer than this version. Mm-hmm. So thank God. Let's give a shout out to our dear friend, John Sweeney, the editor extraordinaire, who I came to nickname the Master Gardener.
Oh, that fits him so well.
Right? He just knew, like, we need to chop down this tree. We need to, like, pull out these weeds and let's plant some more seeds over here, shall we? And, like, let's water this thing and let that grow a little more. Mm-hmm. You know, he really helped this book to become a lot tighter mm-hmm. and the pace to be strong, so that I really think it turned into a great page turner. You know, uh-huh. like the first two people I had read it told me they read the whole thing in two sittings.
Yeah, it's a quick read, but it's also a deep read, which is so wonderful. You know, it's sort of a book that stays with you. And part of it is that you have these beautiful passages like the one you read. You know, there are sentences in that passage that can be like mantras, sort of circulating in your mind over and over and opening things to you. So, but it's an exciting read.
Of course. I mean, it's my heart and I'm not a boring person.
That you are not. It takes me back to when we used to hang out in Wisconsin some years ago. We would drive around, I think, to like this Carmelite shrine.
Yeah.
And you would be like, oh my God, do you see those red chairs by the side of the road? Oh, let's admire them. Let's stop. It's like, these are just red chairs. Okay. But you see, that is also, I think, part of the spiritual gift that you bring, right? Mm. This sense of seeing the extraordinary in things that we are maybe willing to dismiss too easily. Mm. So thank you for that, because that comes through in the book. And so
now, oh, good. You're welcome.
Yes. And so now maybe another kind of approaching the end of this conversation, I have a serious question. As you were working on this book, reexamining journals, reacquainting yourself with some of those experiences, remembering your time at the hospital, but also those first unknowns, both after the accident, but also when you began the journey towards religious life. Mm. I guess my question is, what did you learn about your vocation that's like completely new as you were working on this book?
Finally, you asked me a hard question. Thank you, my friend.
Oh, my goodness.
What did I learn about my vocation?
Because, you know, it's sort of like when you practice nightly examine, you know, oftentimes there's this sense that when you reflect on your day, the moments of your day are like re-gifted to you. You know, you re-experience them, but now in its fullness, in the sense that you see how it all fits. Where was this felt sense of God's presence? So I'm curious, as you spend so much time reflecting on your life, especially that particular period of your life.
Yeah, I'll actually answer the question in light of the process of the book coming into the world and where I am in my own commitment to my religious community at this point, okay? The story is about me in my 20s joining the community. I'm in my 40s now. It's much has shifted in myself and in my congregation. And
does it
I
mean
really,
there's going to be a part two of the memoir?
No, I don't. Oh, dear God, I don't want to do this again. No. Okay.
Remember what you said. The story does not belong to you.
You're right. It doesn't. However, here's the thing. What has occurred as things shift in myself and in my community? And I even think about how I had this real sense of call that the book was supposed to be offered to the world. Mm-hmm. But, and there were all these hiccups and hard things that really complicated and confused that process mm-hmm. of finding a publisher that would take it and so on. What's really happened is my trust in God's providence has deepened.
Mm-hmm.
And I get in a different way now than I did when I was in my 20s than the voice that the reader will encounter in the book got, right? Mm-hmm. This more mature Julia gets that God and life and everything is layered and complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And God's got it. Like, I don't need to worry.
Mm-hmm.
I can really just let go and allow God to manage things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have to force anything. I don't have to agonize. I can just truly try to surrender mm-hmm. and allow grace and providence and God's mercy to be the elements that are presiding mm-hmm. over the liturgy, the mystery of my life and the life of my community.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's trust. Now I trust, mm-hmm. and I have learned to trust the beautiful and creative process of God.
Mm. Wow, that's a very beautiful answer. Thank you for that.
I knew it was a hard question, but I knew if I started talking, I would come up with something.
There you go. So now the final question.
Oh.
Since that one maybe wasn't hard enough.
Yes.
You mentioned that you're now at a different place in your religious life, in your commitment. What is that place? How are you living your religious vocation, really your life, right now? I know you started a community in Chicago, but just maybe a little bit about your life now to also show some of the readers or people who would like to read this book or people who are interested in pursuing a religious vocation.
Yeah.
How exciting this journey can be.
Oh, man. You want me to talk about exciting things? Okay. Well, I was going to say, well, I go to church. I say my prayers. I stay in contact with the poor through the works of mercy, through service. I volunteer at the jail. I meet with people regularly as a minister of discerners who are trying to come to some clarity about who they're called to share their life with, who they are meant to be in the world. I really find it a lot of fun to work with words and speak and preach in a way, right? Mm-hmm. I love sharing the gospel and the goodness of that. That is a lot of my life. But I would say that what's even more core for me is being a community builder, mm-hmm. right? I really believe that people are not meant to be living their life alone,
mm-hmm.
that there's a serious epidemic of loneliness, that isolation is destroying people and communities, mm-hmm. that division is causing extreme social problems. And the best way that we can all respond to that, the way that I feel personally called to respond to that, is to simply be a friendly neighbor and a welcoming presence and invite people into spaces where they can share who they truly are. So I love building up communities where people are talking about things that are of substance and are praying together and breaking bread, sharing food, having parties, learning together. Like, that's, I would say, the heart of what my life is.
Do you want to say more about the community that you...
The Fireplace Community is this community, that started up 3 years ago. Listeners can learn about it by looking at thefireplacecommunity.org. There's two sisters, myself and another, and then there's five women who are presently not sisters and are living in our community with us. And then there's what we call the extended community, who are people that live in the neighborhood or other friends and supporters. And they all join us for dinner and prayer regularly, about twice a week. We host programs and events and prayer experiences in our home, things like open mic or tazay prayer or poetry workshop or collaging event or an art painting workshop. We say that our mission is to offer spiritual support to artists, activists, and spiritual seekers, mm-hmm. because as I see it, and I think we all do in this community, these creative folks are the ones who are changing the culture and systems in society, and they need a spiritual community to support them so they don't burn out. Mm-hmm. So that's the fireplace community. Please come and visit.
Wonderful, wonderful. And so now finally, and this is going to be the most difficult thing that I will ask you to do, a 1-minute pitch about the book. Why should people read it?
For Love of the Broken Body is a spiritual memoir about my novitiate experience and how I learned that brokenness is nothing to be ashamed of. It is a normal and sacred part of being a human. I hope that everyone reads it so they reflect on their own stories and their own sacred brokenness.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Sister Julia, for writing this really special book. Thank you for sharing the gift of your story and your journey with all of us. And I hope that many people will read this. And if you're listening to this, just order the book right now. Don't wait. Right now.
Thank you, Adam Bucko, Reverend Adam Bucko, for your friendship, support, camaraderie, and good questions today. It's a joy to be with you.
Thank you.
Messy Jesus Business is produced and edited by Colin Wamscans.
You can find us online at messyjesusbusiness.com. and on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Patreon. If you like what you heard, please be sure to mention our podcast to your friends and followers. And we'd love to have your support via Patreon. From the bottom of our hearts and the middle of the mess, thank you. Messy Jesus Business is produced in partnership with the Franciscan Sisters of Perpetual Adoration. You can learn more about our religious community and donate to our mission at www.fspa.org. I'm Sister Julia Walsh, and I'll catch up with you next time. Until then, peace and all good.